KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I'm not familiar with anything like this coming out of any White House historically.
President Trump is taking aim at law firms that represent clients or causes that he finds distasteful, a move that legal experts say is unprecedented for any president.
For Wednesday, March 19th, this is All Things Considered.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration has stopped funding efforts to gather evidence of alleged war crimes by Russia.
This work includes tracking Ukrainian children abducted during the war with Russia.
I don't think there's an American, Republican, Democrat, Independent, who would want to see us give up on these children.
Also, tariffs and cuts to federal agencies have meant uncertainty for many farmers.
A lot of our fertilizer comes from Canada. And with tariffs, that's going to really drive up the price of fertilizer.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump is describing a call today with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky as fantastic. NPR's Mara Liasson reports the White House says Trump briefed Zelensky on yesterday's conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin in order to, quote, align the two countries' needs and requests.
Zelensky had already agreed to a 30-day ceasefire plan proposed by the U.S., but Trump has not yet been able to get Putin to commit to a full ceasefire. Russia is insisting on conditions for a ceasefire, including the end of all military assistance to Ukraine. Russia did agree to end attacks on energy infrastructure, but continued bombing Ukrainian cities this week. The White House said that Trump and Zelensky did not discuss the proposed rare earth mineral deal that had been on the table, but they did discuss another potential deal. According to the White House, Trump suggested to Zelensky that U.S. companies could help Ukraine run its nuclear power plants. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
A federal judge is giving the Trump administration an additional day to respond to his questions about weekend deportation flights. NPR's Joel Rose reports the Justice Department is fighting not to reveal details about the flights carrying alleged Venezuelan gang members.
U.S. District Judge James Boasberg has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from using wartime powers to quickly deport migrants from Venezuela that it accuses of being gang members. Now Boasberg is demanding answers from the Justice Department about whether it deliberately flouted his orders when it allowed two deportation flights to continue. But the Justice Department is pushing back. In an emergency filing, lawyers accused Boasberg of, quote, continuing to beat a dead horse. Boasberg agreed to extend his deadline for 24 hours to allow the Justice Department to consider invoking the state secrets privilege. The Justice Department has also appealed Boasberg's orders. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge has denied the request for a temporary restraining order in a lawsuit brought by some of the former board members of the U.S. Institute of Peace, who alleged they were unlawfully removed from their positions. Judge saying fundamental questions remained about the nature of USIP, whether it's an independent agency or whether it falls under the executive branch. Judge did say she was very offended by how DOGE has operated at the Institute's building. The interest rate setting Federal Reserve left rates unchanged at the conclusion of its two-day meeting in Washington today. Fed policymakers saying the economy continues to expand at a solid pace. Fed Chair Jerome Powell also said there are signs the Trump administration's tariff policies are beginning to bite.
Goods inflation moved up pretty significantly in the first 2 months of the year. Trying to track that back to actual tariff increases, given what was tariffed and what was not, very, very challenging. So some of it, the answer is clearly some of it, a good part of it, is coming from tariffs.
Central Bank increased its inflation forecast for the year to 2.7% while reducing its outlook for GDP growth to 1.7%. The Dow is up 383 points. This is NPR. The Vatican says the condition of 88-year-old Pope Francis continues to improve, saying the pontiff no longer needs a non-invasive mechanical ventilation system to help him breathe at night. Officials say Francis is also reducing his reliance on oxygen. Francis suffered from double pneumonia and, while not entirely eliminated, is under control to the point. The Vatican says Francis celebrated Mass today. South African conservation groups are celebrating after winning a legal battle to protect the country's rapidly declining population of African penguins. Kate Bartlett reports the birds' colonies were threatened by overfishing.
It seems South Africa's jackass penguins are having the last laugh. So called for the donkey-like braying sound they make, the iconic black and white birds were facing extinction within the next decade. That's according to two wildlife groups who took the commercial fishing industry and South Africa's Environment Ministry to court to get greater protections for the few breeding colonies left in the Cape. The groups have agreed to no-go zones for the commercial anchovy and sardine fishing vessels that have been decimating the penguins' main food sources. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
A former engineer for rapper Eminem has been charged with stealing a musician's unreleased music and selling it online. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Detroit, engineer Joseph Strange is being charged with copyright infringement and interstate transportation of stolen goods. Strange's lawyer says the charges are untested allegations, and the matter should be handled by the courts. Strange lost his job at the rapper's studio in 2021. Other studio employees reported seeing the unreleased music online. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. President Trump talked repeatedly on the campaign trail about seeking vengeance against his political enemies. Since his return to office, he has followed through on that threat. That includes punishing law firms that have represented people or causes unpopular with the president. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas reports.
In recent weeks, President Trump has used the power of the presidency to take aim at three prominent big law firms. First, Trump took executive action to suspend security clearances for certain attorneys at the firm of Covington and Burling. Days later, he took a much bigger swing at another firm, Perkins Coie, suspending all security clearances held by its employees, prohibiting government contractors from retaining the firm, and barring its attorneys' access to government officials and buildings. A few days later, he followed up with yet another executive order, this time against the New York-based law firm of Paul Weiss.
I'm not familiar with anything like this coming out of any White House historically.
Timothy Zick is a professor at William & Mary Law School.
This is an effort to target and retaliate against law firms that were doing lawful work, advocacy on behalf of their clients.
The reason for Trump's animus differs with each firm. Covington and Burling attorneys represent former Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith, who led the federal investigations of Trump. Perkins Coie represented Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign, and former attorneys there had a hand in the creation of the infamous Trump-Russia dossier. And with the third law firm, Paul Weiss, one of its former attorneys had worked cases against Trump. Speaking with Fox News earlier this month, the president suggested there would be more to come.
We have a lot of law firms that we're going to be going after, because they were very dishonest people. They were very, very dishonest. I could go point after point after point.
Presidents generally have broad authority on national security matters and in granting and revoking security clearances. But two of the law firm orders also implicate free speech, due process, and choice of counsel. Whatever Trump's stated reason may be in each instance, University of Pennsylvania law professor Claire Finkelstein says the president's goal in going after law firms appears clear.
I think if you look at the purpose of the executive orders, it's to intimidate professionals, to intimidate the legal profession from engaging in professional activities that go against Donald Trump and the current administration.
Finkelstein says targeting law firms is part and parcel of a broader assault on the legal community, including the courts. Some federal judges who have ruled against the Trump administration have faced online threats and calls for impeachment. On Tuesday, Trump himself lashed out on social media at a judge handling an immigration-related case and said, in all caps, the judge should be impeached. Again, Finkelstein.
Now they're going after the lawyers and saying, you know, you should be intimidated from even bringing suits that oppose the government in the first place. It's a clear shot across the bow with regard to any law firms that represent clients who want to challenge government action.
In the case of Perkins Coie, the firm is pushing back. It filed a lawsuit last week challenging the president's order. A day later, a federal judge agreed to temporarily block enforcement of the order, saying it likely violates the First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. Despite that ruling, Trump followed up just days later with his new executive order targeting a third big law firm. One of the main questions now is what, if anything, will the legal community do to defend what experts say are bedrock principles of the American legal system? Zink says it's important that law firms present a united front.
There should be significant pushback against this sort of executive action because, you know, your firm could be next or individual lawyers could be subjected to this sort of targeting and retaliation.
Two sources tell NPR there is an effort underway among top lawyers at several big law firms to file a brief in the Perkins case supporting the firm and defending the rule of law. But some law firms are hesitant to sign on, worried about potentially being Trump's next target. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration has canceled a U.S.-funded project to gather evidence of alleged war crimes by Russia in Ukraine. Now, that work includes keeping track of Ukrainian children who are thought to have been abducted to Russia. And in a letter sent to Secretary of State Marco Rubio, a group of lawmakers is urging the administration to reconsider. One of them is Greg Landsman, a Democratic congressman from Ohio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So to be very specific here, the Trump administration has ended its funding of the Ukraine Conflict Observatory, which is housed at Yale University's Humanitarian Research Lab. Can you just very briefly explain what exactly does this group do?
So they track these children in a way that's independent and can be used ultimately to get them home. And you're talking about demographic information, names, confirmation of the fact that they were stolen, where they were taken from, and then using satellite data where they are now.
And why do you think it's specifically in the interest of the U.S. to fund this kind of work?
Well, we have been a partner, obviously, in trying to get Putin out of Ukraine, trying to protect Eastern Europe. And we have invested a lot in the Ukrainian people. One of the things that stood out for me over the course of the last couple of years was what was happening to these children and the fact that in addition to the awfulness of war and the casualties, that Putin was stealing children. And in the process of looking for the data to confirm that, in fact, we had the right numbers and we were using the right information, we learned that the database disappeared. And it disappeared because they cut funding for the work.
Can we talk a little bit more about this database? Like, exactly what kind of information has been uncovered and is part of this database? And how does that information help Ukrainians get these children back home?
Yeah, a couple of things. The Ukrainians wanted an independent third party, capable entity that was run through the State Department to verify the names that the children were still alive, to be able to use satellite information and to track the children so that we didn't lose them. And when the war comes to an end, and hopefully we're getting there, that any ceasefire agreement would involve the return of the children. And so it's a lot of demographic data and a lot of satellite information that we now can't find.
Well, the State Department has confirmed that they did cancel the contract to fund the Ukraine Conflict Observatory. Have you gotten any reasons as to why specifically?
Just the quote from one of the administrators over there who said that, you know, it was part of saving money, but doesn't save any money. The money had been spent. And even if it was something that, you know, should have been looked at, I don't think there's an American, Republican, Democrat, independent who would want to see us give up on these children.
If it is true that this data from the repository has been deleted, even permanently deleted, Can you just talk about what would be the impact of no longer having this information?
It's the difference between showing up to a negotiation with a list of all the names and locations and not having any list at all. Mm-hmm. And so the impact could be...
There's no other source for this information, the location of the whereabouts of these children.
This, as our understanding is that this is the primary, if not, this is the only source.
If you believe the data was permanently deleted, as the letter you sent indicates, do you have any reason to believe that the data is recoverable at this point, though?
We've heard from some folks that are close to the project that it is possible to retrieve the data. Okay. So my hope is that's what ends up happening. The only thing that matters is getting these kids home.
Well, given the direction currently of ceasefire talks between Russia, the U.S., and Ukraine to end this war, how hopeful are you that this particular issue of child abductions is getting the attention it deserves in the middle of all the talks?
So far, I've been really disappointed that it hasn't been front and center. If we lost 10 children, if somebody stole, one American child, we would want that to be top of mind. We would want it to be at the top of the list, and it probably would be. You're talking about 30,000 confirmed children stolen from their families, and it shouldn't even be negotiated. They should just be returned. I hope to see in the coming days and weeks this as a top priority for the administration.
Greg Landsman, Democratic Congressman from Ohio, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio put out a statement today regarding President Trump's phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The statement says the two leaders discussed, quote, the children who had gone missing from Ukraine during the war, including the ones that had been abducted. President Trump promised to work closely with both parties to help make sure those children were returned home, unquote. And in a press briefing today, State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce said the allegation of missing data is false. She added that, quote, we know who is running the data, and we know fully that the data exists, and it's not been deleted, and it's not missing.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. It's National Agriculture Week, and farmers are nervous. They already worry about crop prices, the cost of farm supplies, and extreme weather. And now the federal government is another big question mark. President Trump's tariff war will shape where farmers can sell their crops. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture might be shrinking. To explain the relationship between farmers and the federal government, we've called Ann Veneman, who was President George W. Bush's agriculture secretary. Good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you.
How are Trump's tariffs likely to affect farmers?
Well, as you say, agriculture is an uncertain business. And I think uncertainty is what farmers face every day. But when you add on the disruption of markets due to trade, these tariffs would fall most heavily on the U.S. agriculture industry. So, for example, China has been a major export market for U.S. agricultural products. One quarter of the U.S. crop of soybeans has been exported to China. They may lose that market if the tariffs go back on soybeans like they did in 2018.
Let's shift to the support that USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, provides to farmers. The majority of USDA spending goes to nutrition assistance programs like SNAP benefits, also known as food stamps. If that shrinks, what does that mean for farmers in the U.S.?
Certainly, farmers are supported in many ways. About 14% of USDA's budget goes directly to farm conservation and commodity programs, directly supporting farmers, much of it through subsidized crop insurance to insure against losses. But the USDA has so much more. For example, the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Program has experts working to protect agriculture from pests and diseases, particularly these days, bird flu. You know, we have the Food Safety Inspection Service in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It's responsible for the safety of the meat and poultry. And then, of course, you talk about the nutrition programs. They account for about 70% of the USDA budget.
Yeah.
There is discussion about whether or not the SNAP program, the former food stamp program, will be cut. But there's also discussion about whether or not there may be some limitations on what you could buy.
I think a lot of the debate will probably be around cutting benefits to people in need. But does that have trickle-down impacts or trickle-up impacts on the farmers who produce the foods that become part of that food assistance program?
Well, potentially. There is one program. It's about a $1 billion program that the department has already said it's going to cut. It buys produce locally produced by farmers in the area for food banks and school lunch. That program is already being cut, and farmers that are depending on that program are already feeling the effects of that.
The government has frozen or ended a lot of grants to farmers. Here's what a dairyman named Travis Forbes told Wisconsin Public Radio after the federal government paused 2 5-figure grants he had for a new industrial freezer and solar panels.
We have the contract signed. Did I think that perhaps in the future these grants wouldn't be available? Absolutely, because that happens with different leaders in place. But did I in the wildest dreams think that they wouldn't honor their word as our federal government? Absolutely not.
Secretary Veneman, ultimately at least one of his grants went through, but big picture, what does the uncertainty around this mean for farmers?
Well, it puts them in a very difficult position. They've already started the work. They've already spent their part of the cost share. And if the money is not going to come from the federal government, it puts them in a very precarious position. They may then come under pressure from their banks because they can't pay back their loans. And I think when you have a contract, it should be honored.
When you were in office in the early 2000s as agriculture secretary, what did you hear most from farmers? What did they want the federal government to do more or less of?
Well, farmers always want support, but I will say that farmers really want markets opened up around the world. When you look at what's happening today, when we're shutting off markets, that is exactly the opposite of what farmers wanted when I was at USDA.
Former Agriculture Secretary Anne Veneman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Secretary Veneman described farming there as an uncertain business. Well, uncertainty is also on the minds of economists at the Federal Reserve System. The 12 regional banks that make up the country's central bank regularly study their local economies and publish their findings in a document called the Beige Book. And throughout the latest edition, there's that word again, uncertainty. Robert Smith and Waylon Wong of The Indicator have our Beige Book report.
This time in the Beige Book, one big thing stood out to Robert and me, the word uncertainty. That word showed up 45 times in the Beige Book. That's a new record and more than twice what it's been recently.
Part of that is tariffs. Tariffs were mentioned 49 times in the Beige Book, by the way. The president has been slapping tariffs on and then unslapping those same tariffs and then delaying the slap and then doing that thing where you sort of fake a slap and then point and laugh. Ha ha ha.
And that is creating a lot of feelings, as detailed in the Beige Book. The St. Louis Fed reported about how this uncertainty is affecting agriculture. Farming is an industry where you have to start right now, in the spring, even though the future is scary and unknown. Here is what the St. Louis Fed wrote in the Beige Book.
Quote, a contact in Memphis noted that the current agriculture market was in a worse spot than the same time last year. Contacts noted that tariffs, policy uncertainty, and a lack of clarity regarding farm bill safety nets were negatively impacting the sector. Some farmers also reported having no expectation of profits in the 2025 crop year, and others have gone out of business.
No profits.
I know.
We wanted to hear how farmers are personally navigating this difficult environment.
My name is Zarlin Woodard. I'm a fourth generation farmer in Tunica, Mississippi. My farm is Urban Hills Farms.
Zarlin told us that a lot of the farms do a winter wheat that they sell around the world through USAID, the same USAID that's been essentially cut by the Trump administration. So there's a lot of extra grain sitting around.
And looking forward to this season, Zarlin is worried about the rising cost of fertilizer.
A lot of our fertilizer comes from Canada, and with tariffs that's hitting Canada now, that's going to really drive up the price of fertilizer, which ultimately affects your overall profit margin.
In fact, Zarlin is changing his plans right now based on the tariffs. Rice, the crop rice, apparently takes a lot of fertilizer to grow, so he's switching to soybeans, which requires a lot less fertilizer. But soybean prices are low.
And they're unstable. If Brazil has a big crop, then worldwide prices will drop. And China has just put a 10% tariff on U.S. soybeans in retaliation for our tariffs. Zarlin spends a lot of his time on his phone watching international news and soybean prices.
It'll get to some point to where you have to make that decision to where are you going to continue to farm? Because if you can't make a profit, you know, there's no point in continuing.
So the farm was started by your grandfather. What would he say now?
I don't know what his ideas would be right now. You know, it's tough.
But Zarlin isn't dwelling on it. When we left him, he was staring at soy prices on his phone again, trying to figure out if he should lock in a price now or gamble on it going up later. Robert Smith.
Waylon Wong, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News.
Anti-Semitism is up in the U.S., and the Trump administration says colleges are failing to address it. But some ask if the administration is weaponizing the fight against hate to suppress free speech.
One of the things that's important for our ability to combat anti-Semitism and other forms of hate is having strong democratic institutions.
That conversation on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, confusion over the future of two national monuments here in California.
They encompass the ancestral homelands of at least five tribes.
The actual footprints of the Quetzal people and many peoples, native people of the desert southwest, our footprints are there in this desert.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. In Washington, D.C., a federal judge has denied a request to temporarily block DOJ's takeover of the U.S. Institute of Peace, or USIP. Some former members of that congressionally funded think tank have sued the government, alleging they were unlawfully removed. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
The lawsuit seeks to reinstate the board members who were removed and to block DOJ from further accessing the Institute or its systems. At a hearing in federal court in Washington, D.C., U.S. District Judge Beryl Howell said she was very offended by how DOJ has moved to take over USIP. That includes threatening criminal prosecution and showing up with armed law enforcement to remove senior employees from the building. But Judge Howell says there is confusion in the lawsuit and that she has concerns about its likelihood of success on the merits. She therefore denied the former USIP board member's request for a temporary restraining order blocking DOJ's actions while the lawsuit proceeds. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The Federal Reserve voted to hold interest rates steady today as policymakers take their time to assess the impact of President Trump's policies and escalating trade war. NPR's Scott Horsley says Trump has already imposed 20% taxes on goods from China and all imported steel and aluminum, and he's promised to impose more tariffs next month.
Updated forecasts show members of the Fed's rate-setting committee still expect to lower interest rates by an average of 0.5% later this year if inflation continues to ease. President Trump's tariffs could interrupt that progress on inflation, though. Trump's already imposed taxes on all imported steel and aluminum. He's also promised to impose more tariffs next month.
NPR's Scott Horsley, the Fed's benchmark interest rate helps determine borrowing costs for a variety of credit, including car loans, business financing, and personal credit cards. This is NPR News. Nigeria's president has declared a state of emergency and suspended its governor and lawmakers. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwutu reports his actions are sparking a constitutional crisis in the country that is rich in oil.
Political tensions had brewed for months between the River State governor, Siminalayi Fubara, and state lawmakers, many who were backed by the governor's predecessor. But the crisis has only escalated further with President Bola Tinubu's intervention. He announced a state of emergency this week and the six-month suspension of the governor, his deputy, and the state legislature. The action is widely held as unconstitutional for the president to declare. President Tinubu defended the move, blaming the political tensions and explosions at oil pipelines earlier this week. Emmanuel Akinwutu, NPR News, Lagos.
Regulators with the European Union outlined steps that tech giant Apple must take to work better with competing technologies in Europe. It's the first time the 27-nation bloc has moved to force a tech company to comply with its new digital rulebook, which took effect last year. Apple will have to open up its operating system to allow other developers better access to iPhone and iPad features. Google is also facing similar EU regulations. Stocks finished higher on Wall Street today. The tech-heavy NASDAQ added 246 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station.
And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
On a Wednesday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. During President Trump's first term, Jeanette Vizguerra became something of a national symbol of resistance to Trump's immigration policies. Fearing the government would deport her because she entered the country illegally, Vizguerra took sanctuary in a church in Colorado. But even from inside, she regularly spoke out for immigrant rights. That was 8 years ago, and this week, immigration agents arrested her. NPR's Adrian Florido reports.
On Monday, Jeanette Vizguerra was on her lunch break at a Denver-area Target store when ICE agents moved in. Laura Lichter is her lawyer.
My client says that when she was arrested, the officer said, "We finally got you." And that tells me that there's something more going on here than just profiling middle-aged Mexican women in a Target parking lot.
Vizguerra first came to national attention in 2017. She had been fighting deportation for years. When Donald Trump first took office, she feared she might finally lose that fight and moved into a Denver church. She held a press conference from inside.
Sé que mi lucha no termina aquí. Mi lucha va a continuar.
Even though it's been 8 long years up to this point, I know that this is not the point to give up, and my fight is going to continue.
Her saga started in 2009 when she was convicted for using a fake Social Security card to get a job as a janitor. An immigration judge ordered her to leave the country. But she didn't, and the Obama administration never prioritized deporting her. She just had to check in with immigration agents regularly. Once Trump took office and she moved into the church, Vizguerra became the public face of what was then being called the New Sanctuary Movement. NPR spoke with her a few weeks after she moved into the church.
When we make the decision to seek sanctuary, it's because we have the courage to face our situations, to fight our cases, to resist.
She spoke often to the press, coordinated advocacy, and made sure there was always someone available to pick her kids up from school. They lived at home with their dad, and they would regularly visit her in the church basement. Her lawyers were in constant negotiation with immigration officials. She felt safe enough to permanently leave her sanctuary once President Biden took office. But when President Trump returned this January, her lawyers say she thought they might come for her. Monday, they did. Here's her lawyer, Laura Lichter.
It's nearly impossible to take the politics out of a case like this where the person being targeted by ICE is someone who is an outspoken critic of our immigration laws.
In a statement to NPR, Immigration and Customs Enforcement said, quote, Vizguerra is a convicted criminal alien from Mexico who has a final order of deportation issued by a federal immigration judge. Her attorney says she's fighting to prevent Vizguerra's deportation.
Jeanette is entitled to the protections that she's entitled to under the law.
Free Jeanette!
Better hear
Free
you!
Jeanette. Free Jeanette!
On Tuesday night, Vizguerra's family and supporters held a rally outside the Colorado Detention Center where she's being held. Leaders in the state condemned her arrest. Governor Jared Polis said Vizguerra has no history of violence and poses no threat. Denver's mayor, Mike Johnston, called her arrest, quote, Putin-style persecution of political dissidents. Adrian Florido, NPR News.
Hospitals say more than 430 people have been killed across Gaza. Nearly 700 have been wounded since Israel shattered a temporary ceasefire in a blitz of airstrikes that began before dawn Tuesday. Israeli leaders say this is only the beginning of a new offensive. NPR's Anas Baba in Gaza City and Aya Batraoui in Dubai bring us their reporting on what it's been like in Gaza since the war resumed. And a warning, you will hear graphic descriptions of the war, including the sound of explosions.
It's the middle of the night in Gaza, the ninth week of a ceasefire many hoped would last. Instead, people were jolted awake to the familiar, terrifying sound of Israeli airstrikes. NPR producer Anas Baba in Gaza was one of them.
I don't know what's happening, but it seems that war is back. I don't know exactly what is the target. It seems to be close.
The targets, Israel says, were mid-level and senior Hamas officials. Five of them were killed, Hamas said. To reach them, Israeli warplanes struck tents, homes, and shelters, killing hundreds of people, more than 60% of them women and children, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Around 180 of those killed were children.
There's so many pediatric trauma cases that all the PICU, pediatric ICU beds, are full now.
Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan is an American pediatric intensive care physician volunteering in Gaza's Nasser Hospital with the organization Medical Aid for Palestinians. She describes in voice memos losing patients in the ER and the many more taken straight to the morgue.
The ER was just chaos, patients everywhere on the floor. There were probably three men, and the rest were all children, women, elderly. It was everybody caught in their sleep, still wrapped in their blankets.
She describes a six-year-old girl on one of the beds, partially paralyzed, with the word majhul, or unknown, written in black ink on her arm. And the infant she treated, just a few months old, with her pierced ears.
She looked perfect on the outside, but was pale as a sheet. She ended up having pretty significant internal bleeding, including some shrapnel penetrating her chest wall, and probably has a head injury. I'm told her mom was killed.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the offensive was launched to complete the war's aims of freeing Israeli hostages held in Gaza and destroying Hamas, the group that attacked Israel in 2023. Protests like this one in Israel are demanding he return to negotiations, saying the war endangers hostages. Israel's blocked food, medical supplies, and even fuel from entering Gaza for nearly 3 weeks. Hamas says Israel's far-right government is now finding excuses to return to war. Defense Minister Israel Katz says Hamas must understand the rules of the game have changed, and he had this message for the residents of Gaza.
What comes next will be much harsher, and you will bear the full consequences. Soon the evacuation of the population from combat zones will resume. If all Israeli hostages are not released and Hamas is not removed from Gaza, Israel will act with force beyond anything you've ever seen.
The White House says it was consulted by the Israelis on its attacks. 60-year-old Ismail Zaroub says his daughter's home was among those destroyed in the latest airstrikes. He says to pressure Hamas, they killed 400 people. Why? With what right? He says, where's Trump, who's called for peace? Where's the world? There's no humanity, he says. A woman stands in the street with her three distraught grandchildren after an airstrike damaged their building. She describes what so many in Gaza have already endured. Umm Saif al-Ghurra says her son was already killed at the start of this war with his wife and kids. And her home was bombed in earlier airstrikes. And now this one is too destroyed. She says, this is a calamity. We can't take it anymore. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with Anas Baba in Gaza.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
About a third of the country's climate pollution comes from buildings, and one way to reduce that is to switch from fossil fuel burning appliances to electric ones. The thing is, that can require expensive electrical upgrades, but manufacturers are working to make it easier. Here's NPR's Jeff Brady.
In a Manhattan apartment, Max Van Gilder is making spaghetti carbonara.
Mix the eggs and the garlic together.
On his new stove, there's pork sizzling in a frying pan. Van Gilder is a retired pediatrician and wanted to replace his old gas stove with a new electric one.
As I'm getting older, I was afraid that I would leave the gas on.
And to save energy, he wanted an induction stove that heats pans with magnetism rather than flames. But switching required expensive electrical work. Then he found a company called Copper. It makes induction stoves that plug into a regular outlet. A battery under the oven charges through the night and powers the stove, eliminating the big plug most electric ranges have. Van Gilder likes his new stove, but it came with a hefty price.
The base price is $6,000. There's a tax credit that brings it down to about $4,000.
Copper CEO Sam Kalish says that's still a bargain for older multifamily buildings with gas pipes that sometimes leak climate warming methane.
In these cases, we install for less than half of what it costs just to fix the gas system. And then we allow that building to retire that old aging infrastructure and decarbonize.
Beyond stoves, companies are making heaters and air conditioners that plug into a standard outlet. Joe Soto is testing one in his Woodside, New York apartment.
I call ourselves the guinea pigs.
The New York City Housing Authority used to heat Soto's home with steam radiators.
No, it wasn't very reliable. There are times that we spend many winters freezing in the cold.
Now his two-bedroom apartment has three window heat pumps that save energy by extracting heat in one place and moving it to where it's wanted, similar to how a refrigerator works. These heat pumps are mounted like a window air conditioner, and Soto says they also cool his apartment in the summer.
The temperature's been constant. Winter and the summer, you don't feel the difference.
One company making these window heat pumps is Gradient, where Vince Romanin is the founder and chief technology officer.
We can install our system without any building modification, without any electricians, without holes in the wall, without asbestos mitigation, without scaffolding. All of these things. It is 30-minute install, so we're in and out of the resident's home.
Heat pump technology is used in water heaters, too, and there's a plug-in version designed to replace a gas water heater.
It was all done in one day. It wasn't a major overhaul.
Laura Nakamura in Concord, California, got one last year and says it's louder than her old gas one because there's a fan, but it also blows cold air, which should cool down her garage in the summer. And it works as well as her gas water heater did.
It's just as hot and the water is still just as wet.
She jokes, but plug-in heat pump water heaters do take longer to warm up. James Courtney is with the water heater manufacturer Rheem.
Because of the slower recovery, we do often recommend that those are installed in warmer states. Really, the main thing is the incoming groundwater temperature.
Warmer water requires less energy to make it hot. Rheem says water heaters like this are still a small portion of the overall market, but the fastest growing. And Panama Bartholomew with the Building Decarbonization Coalition says more products like this are coming.
I know there are manufacturers that are looking about putting batteries inside heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems.
He says those will plug into a regular outlet too, and with a battery, they'll continue working when the power goes out. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration said in a document published on Friday that it was eliminating two national monuments in California, monuments initially created by the Biden administration. Then the Trump administration updated the document, removed the reference, and sparked confusion over the monument's future. NPR's Nate Perez reports.
There's an area in Southern California where the Mojave and Sonoran deserts meet. This is home to Cholla and Soweto cactus, rugged mountains, and the endangered desert tortoise. This is Chuckwalla National Monument. It's named after a big-bellied lizard with flappy skin that roams the southwest desert. Gary Resvaloso drives his truck down a rugged sandy road, pointing out landmarks.
So it's called Painted Canyon, right? It's the red, the bluish, and all that.
Resvaloso is a Torres Martinez Desert Cahuilla tribal member and a tribal council member. He says the red rocks out here signify the blood of Muka, the Cahuilla tribe's creator, after a coyote grabbed Muka's heart and ran with it.
As he ran with it, the blood dripped on the mountains out here on the Painted Canyon area. It's called Cahuish Luish. That means red rock.
These are the ancestral homelands to at least five tribes, including the Cahuilla and the Quetzal tribes.
The actual footprints of the Quetzal people and many peoples, native people of the desert southwest, our footprints are there in this desert.
That's Donald Madar Jr. He's with the Fort Yuma Quetzal tribe. He says he takes his kids out to the area to show them the history of their creation.
For us, it's a burial ground. It's an area of trade. It's an area where we left artifacts from village sites.
Around 710,000 acres are now protected from new development and critical mineral mining. Chuckwalla doesn't have a visitor center yet. A patch of dirt functions as a parking lot, and there are trails, but hardly any signs. Nada Wolf Kolber helped establish the monument before she left the Bureau of Land Management in January.
What makes this place amazing is how it survives and thrives in the desert. That makes the people who survive and thrive there amazing.
But protecting places like Chuckwalla have at times been contentious. Last Friday, after my reporting trip, President Trump caused concern among tribes and conservationists. The administration put out a document announcing the elimination of Chuckwalla and another monument in Northern California, then adding to the confusion, that language was later removed. During Trump's first term in office, he did reduce the monument boundaries for Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante in Utah to try and spark uranium mining and oil and gas drilling, but Biden reversed that. So for now, Chuckwalla remains, and tribes are moving ahead with forming a tribal commission to work with the BLM to manage the land. That's according to Wolf Kolber.
It leaves it up to the tribes to decide how they would like to create that, not to tell them what to do as sovereign nations.
But not everybody's happy about Chuckwalla. Take the city of Blythe, about an hour east from the monument, where around 18,000 people live. One of the city's main employers, a state prison, closed last year. The population of Blythe has declined nearly 20% in the past decade. Vice Mayor Johnny Rodriguez says the monument takes up too much land and threatens the survival of their city.
All it's going to do is kill any future potential development that could help our area.
That's why Rodriguez and other city officials hope the Trump administration will adjust Chuckwalla's boundaries to open the door for any future energy production, such as lithium for electric vehicle batteries. That leaves conservationists like Kelly Herbinson with the Mojave Land Trust worried about the future of this monument and other public lands.
We really need to be thoughtful about protecting big, big swaths of nature, whatever is left, so that we can maintain that ecosystem function for humans to be able to survive.
As for the tribes, Donald Madar Jr. says his people have been here since the beginning of time.
And we're going to continue to do that. You know, no matter what happens today or tomorrow or next week, we will always thrive within this region.
But he says having monument status will help protect their ancestral home. Nate Perez, NPR News.
The White House responded to a request from NPR asking to clarify the monument's status. They pointed us to the president's executive order from Friday, which makes no mention of changes to the monuments.
It is a rare bit of lovely news. Two astronauts returned to Earth this week after more than 9 months in space after their week-long mission went awry. They landed in waters off Florida as dolphins played all around their capsule.
And splashdown, Crew 9 back on Earth.
And thousands of miles away in India, there were other celebrations, as NPR's Dia Hadid reports.
One village in particular celebrated as NASA welcomed back Butch Wilmore and Sunny Williams back to Earth. Residents of Dolomite, the ancestral home of American astronaut Sunny or Sunita Williams. In video by the Indian agency ANI, they set off fireworks to celebrate her arrival. The day before, villagers performed a special prayer, an aarti, for her safe return. Williams' cousin, 84-year-old Dinesh Rawal, lives in the nearby city of Ahmedabad. He says the family is so happy that she's back. We met Rawal at his home.
Namaste.
As we sit down, he pops Milky Sweets into our mouths to celebrate Williams' return.
You're going to feed me too.
All right,
go
on.
Rawal says they really began to worry about Williams as her eight-day space mission had become
9 months or 13 days.
Rawal says his uncle, Williams' father, migrated to the U.S. in the 50s as a student, but he never lost touch, and Williams came back a few times as well. He says as a kid, she liked running after the village goats. On her recent trips back, she was feted as a prominent astronaut with Indian heritage. In one photo, residents place an honorary white turban on her head. He says all Indians are proud of Williams, including the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. He congratulated her on X, saying she was an example of, quote, grit, courage, and the boundless human spirit. And she's testament to the success of Indian migrants in the U.S. Rawal says William's father was invited to the U.S. in the 50s to study medicine.
American government ke finance se wo wahan gaye the.
On the taxpayer's dime, he says. So I ask if the investment has been paid off. Rawal says he hopes Williams will visit India soon. Of course, she'll be celebrated, but mostly Rawal wants to see her.
Ek dafa main jab tak jinda hu.
He says he knows Williams will come and visit while he's still alive. India, after all, is closer than outer space. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Ahmedabad.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at GCI.com/internet.